If for people to believe in my experience I'd have to become something I am not, I prefer that no one believe a single word. I've never been perfect and I'll never be. I'm not a saint either. When I was just a teenager I was stopped going out of a department store with a young aunt of mine for trying to leave without paying for some merchandise. When I was a kid my brother and I were very mischievous. On April 11, 1991 I was arrested along with a friend of mine for possession of a marijuana cigarette, so yes, I've even smoked pot. I'm actually still in on probation. All these facts are true, as are the ones that occurred to me that late evening. It was getting to the point with Mr. P that I was really close to sending him to hell. Everything has its limits, and though I didn't pay much attention to his demands, what really set me off was that he told me I couldn't talk to Mercedes again. He said I couldn't trust her, that I should stay away. In fact, he pretty much wanted me to stay away from everyone. The last time we argued over these matters I told him that not he or anybody else was going to meddle in my personal affairs, that I was not his case, and that the pictures and the negatives belonged to me. This got him so angry that his white face twitched as if possessed. As he spoke his words full of anger a white slobber drained from his lips. I'll never forget his last words to me, "Don't you worry 'cause I'm going to fuck you over. Goodbye brother and God bless you." After that I was completely convinced that this individual was a psychopath. I didn't pay much attention to his threats though. However, since then he's done nothing but try and destroy my credibility. His defamatory voice has spread everywhere around me. This of course occurred behind my back. Meanwhile I was finally able to move into the little house. There I felt happy and secure. How I finally came to live there is still a mystery. Nobody believed that in 1 month's time after seeing the house for the first time I was living there. What was incredible about it was that from the moment I saw it I knew I'd live there. On my spare time at the restaurant I would just sit and stare at that little house across the street. I felt inexplicably drawn to it. It had nothing in particular, only that it felt familiar to me. I wanted to go in and see whoever was living there. I observed its occupants and considered them intruders. I know it sounds absurd and ridiculous, but those were my thoughts and feelings at the time. This one particular night the restaurant was about to close and I was still serving a lady in one of the tables. While I served her dinner we got to talking and she mentioned that she was from the area and that her husband owned a cafe in Bokaran. I let her enjoy her meal and went to look at the house from one of the windows. I hadn't noticed that the woman had seen me do this. When I then brought her the coffee and dessert she'd ordered she asked me what was I looking at from the window with such fixation. At first I didn't know what to say. "It's really very silly, but I was looking at my little house," I said. "Your house?" - she asked. She then said that wasn't possible since she knew the owner of the house and the people renting it. I then told her what I'd meant and also about my fascination with the house and its surroundings. She smiled and told me how the people renting the house were 1 month behind in their rent and that for that, and other reasons, they were considered bad tenants. The woman finished her dinner and I accompanied her to her car. When I came back to the table I found a very generous tip and a card with her name, her husband's name, and their phone number. On the other side of the car she had written, "Go by the clothing store that's in front of the church tomorrow. Ask for Mrs. Beera." I couldn't sleep last night because of what she had written on the card. Early the next day I went to the place she'd mentioned. I asked for Mrs. Pira and I was then introduced to a woman of short stature and short white hair like the snow. She was around 60 years old. Immediately she said she knew I wanted to rent the house. I nodded. Very affectionately she said that she would hand me the key by the end of the week. She asked if I agreed and I again nodded in response. I came out that store walking like a zombie. I realized I hadn't uttered a single word in front of Mrs. Beera. I couldn't believe it. It wasn't until a few hours later that it dawned on me that I was going to live that little house. I was given the keys and much to the surprise of some people I moved in. I remember the first day I got there, it was as if I'd been there before. I knew where everything was. It was exactly as I'd imagined it 1,000 times before. I went to the room that would be my bedroom and sat in the middle of the floor and cried like a small child. To this day I don't know why I cried. When I was bringing in my things I thought about the pictures and the negatives. I wanted to live in this new home with no worries, so I finally decided to burn them. Most of them I burned in front of my family and one I gave to Mercedes so that she would have the privilege of doing it. I felt as though a great weight was lifted off my shoulders. I kept the ashes for memory. Only my closest relatives saw all the pictures, the ones with the alien object with the plane, and of its crew. After all this, a particular picture that had no apparent explanation came to my possession. But more of that later. Chapter 13. By now my brother Charlie and his wife had already transferred from Japan to the United States. On their way over there they stopped in Puerto Rico to visit us. While he was here, he gave me the rest of the negatives he still kept and I put an end to the damn issue once and for all. In this house that I've already mentioned on numerous occasions, I spent the most beautiful moments of my life. There was a garage next to the house which we call a Marxina. There I hung a hammock and placed various chairs. From here I witnessed many fabulous sunsets. I used to love to lie on my hammock in the late afternoons and watch this ball of fire descend until it disappeared. I was at peace and ignorant to Mr. B's exploits behind my back. One day when I got home I found Jorge Martin and Mercedes waiting for me. They had come to warn me about Mr. B. They informed he was going around bad-mouthing me out of revenge. And why? Because I wouldn't let myself be dominated by him. Because I excluded him from my circle of friends for always thinking about the money he'd make off of my pictures, the pictures he felt he had a right to. I also believe that besides money he also wanted recognition. He desired this and also to be a part of the group of people that were close to me and that had gone through an experience like mine. Mr. B was basically taking true facts and twisting them to the extent of making them totally unrealistic. He would also just flat out lie to discredit me. The issue with the marijuana cigarette he turned into a drug trafficking novel. He said that I was one of the biggest drug dealers in the country and that agents had raided my hot dog stand and had found copious amounts of drugs. He also had the nerve of telling my customers not to go my hot dog stand because they could get arrested. He even said I would sell the drugs inside the hot dogs. The Tamarindo took a serious blow with all this. I have to give Mr. B credit because his lies got the job done. Me business was falling apart like Tamarindo pods gone bad and falling from the tree. I ran into some of my clients in town and they all said the same thing, that they were scared of going to my business because of what Mr. B had said. The whole issue of me being homosexual he also twisted to his advantage. He turned into something ugly and perverse. I know some people already think of homosexuality that way, so imagine what happened when Mr. B added his monstrous scenes to the whole thing and spread this among the people that knew me. He actually rejoiced from the results of his actions. The Tamarindo was sinking like the Titanic, but I did not abandon ship. At the restaurant other horrendous problems surged, so I left. All of a sudden everything in my life seemed grey and hopeless. If it hadn't been for the support I got from my family, Mercedes, and the Muckaches, I would have been screwed. Besides the things I've already mentioned Mr. B was doing, he also dedicated his time to saying that my pictures and my whole experience with extraterrestrial beings was all humbug. This, however, was a little harder to back up since there were documents containing scientific evidence that destroyed his allegations. Nevertheless, he insisted. To refute him, Mr. Martin published those documents, but Mr. B was dead set on spreading his poison. By then the depression started to sink in. Everything I'd done seemed to be in vain. I had to endure the cruelties of people who didn't believe as well as the defamation of the vindictive body. Where were these other people? The ones who were with me in the projection room? During these days of the defamation campaign, other pseudo-researchers of lesser names joined Mr. B in his actions. They felt important by merely attacking Mr. Jorge Martin, who happens to be the number researcher in the country of the UFO phenomenon. They envied his international status as a renowned researcher and they tried to discredit him through me. I know these are unfortunate events, but it's how they happened, so therefore it's how I have to tell them. I tried to keep all this from my grandmother and pretended everything was all right. Mr. B managed to destroy many beautiful relationships in my life, he destroyed my social life, and by boycotting my business he left me in ruins. What he wasn't able to do was sell my pictures, destroy true friendships, and though my business was bankrupt, it was still standing. The most important thing was that he was not able to impede something truly wonderful, my coming together with some of the people that were with me in that initial experience. Also, he was not able to prevent the next encounter with the human not of this earth, Amaran. Chapter 14. It was around 6 p.m. and I was putting in the refrigerator the leftovers from work that day when I heard a car park in front of gate. I went to the balcony to see who it was. A woman about 25 years old got out of the car. She asked me if I was a Maori. I said yes but immediately regretted it. "How can I help you?" I asked. The passenger door then opened and an older woman came out. She introduced herself as Matilda and mother of the other lady. She got closer to the gate and said she seriously needed to talk to me. I imagined it probably had to do with the UFOs. I remember thinking that now I'd done it, that now I would have a bunch of curious people coming to the house. The older lady told me she had been with me that night. I just stood there thinking another one. I had already lost hope in finding even one person that was there with me. I asked her as politely as I could what was the name of our human host. "Amaran," she replied. At that moment my head started spinning, my knees bended and I couldn't move my jaw. I then reacted and ran inside to get the key to the gate. I got so nervous I couldn't find the key in my keychain. While I opened the gate I asked her what was the name of Amaran's home planet. "Ka, like the letter K," she replied. I opened the gate and hugged her and didn't want to let go. Her daughter watched us in disbelief. Matilda started to cry while we still hugged. Between the sobs she said to her daughter, "You see now that what I said was true. I told you and you didn't believe me." Apparently nobody believed her incredible story, including her daughter. Thought this woman was much older than I was, it felt as though I was hugging a little girl that was scared and confused. I felt so deeply for her I only wanted to comfort her. I imagined she must have suffered much not only from the experience but from everything that came with it. Her daughter then started to cry as well and begged her mother to forgive her for the ill treatment. She said there was nothing to forgive since she understood how difficult the situation was. We sat in the garage and talked for hours about what had happened back in May 1988. Mrs. Matilda told me specific details about the experience that only someone who'd been there could have known, details I kept close to my chest with the intent of being able to discern who had actually been there during those horrible moments. Her daughter looked at us like she couldn't comprehend the instant bond her mother and I had. She looked at her mom as if she didn't know her. She gave me her telephone number and address and we agreed that I'd call her soon to meet again. They left my house late that night. I felt a little melancholy in my soul. I didn't want her to leave. That night, as I lay on my bed alone, I went through everything we talked about. The koi's, crickets, and other nocturnal animals accompanied me with their nocturnal symphony. I was in a sort of ecstasies for having met her. All she said I recorded in my mind and I reviewed it with great satisfaction. What was most interesting to me was how they took her. She explained that that night she couldn't sleep because it was around 3 in the morning and her youngest son of about 22 years hadn't gotten home yet. He was with his girlfriend and future in-laws. She had tried calling them but the phone was always busy. She was anxious and angry that her husband slept like a baby. Her husband sleeping, her son partying, and she was all alone. Her eldest daughter was married and didn't live with them. Mrs. Matilda decided to stay up and wait for her son. She made herself a cup of tea and went out into their patio. She lived in a place where houses are right next to each other. In spite of that, she had created a sort of garden in her backyard with chairs and ornamental plants. This was her favorite part of the house. With her tea in hand, she sat down first and then paced back and forth in the backyard. The night was cool, but with the tea and her pacing she kept worn. She thought about all the things she'd tell her son when he arrived. "Why didn't you call me?" was the first thing she would ask. All of a sudden she heard a noise coming from inside the house. Because she hadn't heard her son's car pull up, she thought it was probably her husband who'd gotten up to go to the bathroom or get a glass of water. She headed inside when she felt someone touching her shoulder. She screamed, and when she turned around she was face to face with a little man with big head and bulging eyes. The last thing she felt was the hot tea over her nightgown. When she came to, it was already morning and she was seated on one of the chairs in the garden. She felt a sting in her skin. Her breasts and abdomen were irritated and her nightgown was stained. She picked up her empty teacup quite further away from where she woke up. She had apparently fallen asleep waiting for her son. She had no memory of the encounter with the stranger with the bulging eyes. Her husband was still asleep and her son had arrived and was also asleep. In that divine Sunday tranquility, Mr. Matilda put the teacup in the kitchen sink. She washed up, changed her gown, got in bed with her husband, and went to sleep. She slept till noon. The first thing she did when she woke up was question her son. He in turn wished her a happy Mother's Day. With that she was disarmed. This was how Mrs. Matilda celebrated Mother's Day, as if nothing out of the ordinary had happened. However, there was something that bothered her, something with no logical explanation. How could she have spilled hot tea all over her and not have woken up? Also, if she had indeed fallen asleep waiting for her son, why was the teacup so far away from where she was seated? That strange situation was apparently quickly forgotten. What still bothered her was that now she couldn't go out into her backyard alone at night like she used to. For this she had no logical explanation. She also told me of a recurring nightmare. She dreamt she was in a huge circus tent. It was empty but there was light, and even though it was supposed to be a circus, the rare in there was depressing. The vivid colors inside scared her, and as the dream progresses she got even more scared. Suddenly midget clowns appeared with white makeup in their faces and dark circles around their eyes. Their clothes were brightly colored but didn't reflect fun or joy. The midgets started to chase her, and when they got her she would wake up screaming. Her husband didn't know what to do or think. During the day his wife was the same normal person she'd always been, but at night it was like he didn't know her. Years went by and the nightmares started to fade away, but she still couldn't go out to the backyard alone. Some thought she had gone mad. Her family started to see her differently, that is, until that Thursday evening. After that special Thursday they almost had her committed. She had planned to watch the show Adjust in Limite that night with her husband. That night the show was going to be about extraterrestrials. She was used to watching the show. Her husband sat on the sofa while she went into the kitchen to prepare some of their favorite tea. When she came back with the tea she was paralyzed because of something she saw on the television. Her husband asked what was wrong but she didn't answer. He insisted since she looked stiff like a statue. Mrs. Matilda told me she saw a face that had left her paralyzed. She started to tremble so hard she started to spill the tea. The hot tea made her scream and react. This got her husband very scared. It was in this moment she was able to remember, and it was then that her husband and family thought she had definitively gone mad. She bought the magazine not too long after the show, called the number provided on it, and found out how to get in touch with me. They gave her instructions on how to get to the Tamarindo. When she got there I was already gone. She and her daughter asked the people around the neighborhood where to find me, but none one knew where I was. They decided to drive around in the hopes of finding me. After a while they gave up and decided to go back to their homes. Trying to leave Garba Rojo they got lost. They drove for a while trying to get out of town. When they passed a little wooden house, Mrs. Matilda got very anxious and told her daughter to go back. Her daughter became alarmed and asked what was wrong. She said she didn't know why, but she knew she would find me in that house. This is how this lady, whom I now consider family, found me. Months after I made that calling in the various media, I finally found a person who shared that experience with me. That night I dreamt of clowns, midgets, and different colored balloons. It was a circus. In the crowd I saw Mrs. Matilda smiling and happy. I spent the entire next day in the Tamarindo thinking of her. It was still hard to believe that I finally got in touch with one of those other people. But more incredible was what awaited me home that afternoon. I went to Mama's house to take her a carton of milk she had asked me for. I was tempted to tell her about Mrs. Matilda, but I reconsidered since I didn't want to get her anxious again. I talked with her for a while and then I headed home. On my way I thought about calling Mercedes and Anna to tell them about Mrs. Matilda, but I decided that for the moment I'd keep it to myself. I had only shared with them part of my initial experience with those beings. Maybe I just wanted this to be very personal. When I got home there was a car parked outside. When I got out of my car to open the gate the driver of the other car got out. As he approached me I looked at him with mistrust. What did this guy want? I thought. The way things are nowadays you never know. He stretched out his hand as he said my name. I didn't know him, but the fact that he knew my name puzzled me a bit. I asked how could I be of service. In that moment I thought that maybe he was a debt collector from the bank. He said he needed to talk to me. Without opening the gate and my car's engine still running I listened to him. It's about the television show, he said. He also said, you made a calling. I turned my car off and I listened more carefully. He started to talk a little faster. There were 15 of us, not 20, and you were the last they brought in. He said he didn't remember the others' faces but he recognized me and the television. He confessed he became terrified and didn't speak to anyone during the show. He hadn't mentioned anything new though. What he'd just said didn't prove anything. As if reading my mind he said, that man, Amaran, showed some videos that looked very real. He'd hit the nail on the head. Do you remember Amaury when he showed us the images from his home world? Do you remember the dinosaur? He also said that Amaran had told us the name of his planet but that he didn't remember what it was. I told him it was Kar, like the letter K in our alphabet. Yes, Kar, like the letter, that's how he told us, he concluded. I then opened the gate and invited him inside. I asked him to sit in one of the chairs and I sat on my hammock. I asked what town he was from. I had never visited the towns he mentioned. He said his name was Oscar and that he was a police officer. We talked for hours as we smoked and drank sodas. He told me he didn't go to work that day in order to come see me, something he wanted to do since he saw the show but was afraid to. He found me the old-fashioned police way. I asked if he struggled with nightmares after the experience. He said he didn't but that he did dream of prehistoric animals, nothing negative. For example, one of his most recurrent and clear dreams was that he had in his backyard a monkey, a pig, and a dinosaur as his pets. In his dream it was totally normal to have a dinosaur as a pet. He didn't consider this a nightmare. He actually thought it was funny. Oscar is married and has one 18-year-old daughter. His wife, thankfully, understands him and supports him since she loves him very much. He said his wife did think he was crazy but that she took it because of the love she has for him. After watching the show where it was mentioned that my whole experience would be published on a local magazine, he anxiously waited to buy it. He said he got a little crazy while reading the article and that when he was done he cried like a little kid. He didn't know how to tell his wife he was one of the people mentioned. His wife was shocked since she had never seen him cry, yet she didn't say anything negative to him. I told Oscar about Mrs. Matilda and he became ecstatic and wanted to meet her immediately. I told him the three of us would soon get together to talk more about what had happened. Oscar told me about his own experience without difficulty. Although he was apparently affected by the whole thing, it wasn't enough to obstruct his daily responsibilities. I'll now narrate what happened to him that night just as he told me. His sister was visiting him with her husband and children. He'd had some drinks with his brother-in-law, who ended up drinking too much. Oscar decided to take them home in their car. He would come back in the same car, and he would then take it back the next day. It had already gotten late by the time he headed back. About 15 or 20 minutes before getting home the car broke down. It looked as if it was the battery. He decided to go call his wife to come pick him up, so he then rolled up the windows. He didn't hear anything and didn't see any little men. He only remembers that one moment he was rolling up the windows and the next it was already morning. His watch reads 7 a.m. He had no logical explanation for this. All the windows were closed. He thought that perhaps he fell asleep because of the drinks he had, but that it was unlikely since he never drinks to the point of passing out or falling asleep. He was going to get out of the car to call his wife, who was probably hysterical at that point, but decided to try and turn the car's engine on instead. After turning the key, the car started. When he got home, his wife and daughter were hysterical. They both talked at the same time and he couldn't understand a thing. When he was able to explain what had happened, they both thought it was impossible. They had called all their relatives and nobody knew where he was. Oscar's sister told them he had already left them and had taken off. They then called the police, but they also didn't know, but that no accidents had been reported in the area. They called the hospital, but it was of no use. They decided to wait, but since he still hadn't arrived, they got in their car and drove the same route to his sister's house. On their way back and driving slower, they looked for the car at the sides of the road, but they weren't successful. That's why they didn't believe him when he told them about the car breaking down and falling asleep. The incident caused a lot of trouble for the married couple because his wife suspected something else was going on. As time went by, it was all forgotten until a Thursday evening while watching television. The next day, he bought the magazine mentioned on the show. To clarify everything, we both went to a payphone and called his wife. I talked to her for a while. Later Oscar told me she had taken it very well. After talking to me, she now thinks differently about the whole thing. She now believes her husband, knows he's not crazy, and that he doesn't have a lover. Chapter 15. I had now met two of the people I was looking for. In all truth, I would have been happy with just one, but there were now two people who were able to give many small details about the encounter. Not only did they give me Amaran's name and where he came from, but also other information and descriptions about the holographic scenes. I didn't tell Mama or anyone else about my two visitors. I thought that for the moment that was best, that it would save me and these people from further complications. Mrs. Matilda and Oscar had put their trust in me and I didn't want to cause them any inconveniences. All this happened in two straight days. The third day I was anxious to close up the Tamarindo and go home. I was still probably wasting my time since nobody was coming to eat a single hot dog. That day I closed early and went home. I had a feeling someone else was going to show up. I lay on my hammock and waited there. After a while I got hungry and went inside to get something to eat. While I was cooking, I constantly looked out the window to see if anybody came up. I had my diner seated on my hammock, but nobody came. I got tired of waiting, and when the mosquitoes became too much to bear, I went inside to watch television. I did it only to kill time, since I didn't really pay attention to what I was watching. I then heard a noise outside. I looked outside the window and there was a man standing beside the trash. I knew it, I thought to myself. I went up to the gate and noticed the top of the trash can was on the ground next to this man's feet. He man looked at me but didn't say a word. I greeted him and inquired why he was there. He got nervous and apologized. He said he wouldn't make a mess of the trash, that he only wanted to get the aluminum cans to sell them for recycling. I realized that he wasn't part of the group. I told him it was no problem at all and that he could take all the cans he wanted. I went back inside to watch the television and then fell asleep. I was then woken up by the honk of a car. Must be one of my cousins, I thought while half asleep. When I looked out the balcony, I saw a couple get out of the car. They looked probably 25 years old each. They smiled and approached my gate made out of cyclone fence. They wore modern, hip clothing. They asked my name and at the same they both said they'd come from far away and they wanted to talk to me if I had time. Although I could guess what this was about, I asked them anyways. The woman, whom we'll call Maribel, was the one who answered me. "We want to talk to you about the letter K." They then awaited my reaction. Not only did I woke up, but I immediately shook off my drowsiness and told them I was going to get the key for the gate. The man, whom we'll call Raoul, said not to bother, and they both jumped over the fence like two trained athletes. They were very agile. The first thing I thought was, how could the big-headed little men catch up to these two? The jumping couple had also been there. I told about them, about Mrs. Matilda and Oscar.